Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week's guest on the podcast is Ben Griffiths, co-founder, principal, and portfolio manager of Ellie Griffiths Group. His team have racked up a pretty impressive track record in the 16 years since they launched the fund, exceeding their benchmark by nearly 5% per annum after fees over that period. In this week's episode, we'll discuss why he thinks markets are at a major inflection point, why the economic outlook for Australia might not be as bad as it looks, and his three simple rules that he wouldn't invest without. Finally, if you're loving The Rules of Investing, why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to iTunes and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast, and therefore, the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Ben, welcome to the show.
Pat, it's great to be here.
It's great to finally be sitting down with you for a chat. I've been reading your wires and seeing you on Buy, Hold, Sell for so long now that it feels like I actually know you quite well, despite this being the first good long chat that we've had a chance to have. But I know not everybody is going to be as familiar with your style and philosophy as I am. So why don't we start there? How do you describe your approach to investing, and how do you think it's different from other small mid managers around in Australia?
Yeah, that's a great place to start, and a very reasonable question, Pat. Look, we're a manager that's been around a long time. We opened the doors in 2003. Brian Ely and myself opened the doors, and I guess the whole purpose was to bring some discipline and some structure to small company investing. It's a part of the market where momentum has traditionally been a great driver of stock selection and portfolio management. We decided to bring some smarts, some system smarts, and we designed an investment process that we think's reasonably unique out there. And we borrow heavily on some quantitative techniques and some qualitative techniques. The quantitative technique or the tool is primarily our GARP methodology. It's basically what is a reasonable PE for a given level of earnings per share growth looking forward for 3 years. We want to buy...
So GARP is growth at a reasonable price, yeah?
That's what GARP is. Yeah. And so we styled our quantitative assessment more or less along the principles of GARP. And then on the qualitative side, and we figured if all you did was run a GARP portfolio, you'd probably have some luck, you might even go okay, but you'd end up blowing yourself up because there are so many qualitative features and factors that need to be considered when you're investing in small companies that to not have them as a part of your process would be negligent. And primarily we're talking about management. We're talking about the quality of management, the experience, the commitment, the vision of management, and we're also talking about the industry within which your stocks or your companies operate. We know that small companies thrive in reasonably consolidated and rational industries. We don't like wildly fragmented industries. We like there to be a profit motive at every point in a given industry. So if you can buy a company that scores well on your GARP principles, you grow for a reasonable price, that has superior management and industry features, then you're a long way down the chute to having yourself a successful investment. And that's the process that we crafted and constructed back in 2000, actually, preceding the start of Ely Griffiths Group. It's the process we use today. Now, you asked also in the question how we differ to competitors and how we differ to other small cap managers. Well, quite apart from the fact that we've got this very disciplined process, I think what stands us apart from others is the bench strength and the amount of experience that this team has. This is a team that collectively speaks to about 80 years of direct financial markets experience. There aren't too many teams in the market who could boast that, let alone in the small cap market. And of course, half the team, in fact, two-thirds of the team were actively investing in the market and managing money in the market during the period of the GFC. And we'll probably touch on the GFC period back in sort of 2007 to 2009 for those listeners who may not be au fait with it. That was a big differentiator. So we've got a seasoned team. We've got a team that's particularly hands-on with its investing. And most importantly, above all, we do the work, but we are attuned to the vagaries of the market. There are plenty of analysts out there that spend time crafting a beautiful spreadsheet and can refine their earnings forecasts. Not so many can navigate the market. Our team can.
Well, let's talk a little bit about where you're investing then. Obviously, you're a small cap manager. How do you find that differs from investing in large caps? Are there any significant differences in your approach to how a large cap manager might think about things?
Well, there's two answers there, Pat. In the first instance, there's probably not a lot of difference between how we invest versus a large cap manager. We're all trying to maximize our risk-adjusted rates of return. We're all trying to buy stocks that go up. We're trying to minimize the risk in that process. We're trying to buy earnings cheaply. We're trying to buy sustainable earnings. We all want a strong return on equity for our companies. We all want an appreciating marginal return on equity. We want to see strong free cash flows. So I think there's a lot in common between small cap managers and big cap managers in terms of the companies they target and the outcomes they achieve or they desire. But I think there's some very critical differences that make small cap managers a little bit more adept, in my opinion, and a bit more skillful. Their trade craft is a lot more involved, and a couple of issues to consider when answering that question. The first element would be liquidity. We can't go too far without having to consider liquidity whenever we make an investment. That dictates how quickly we can get in or out of a stock, how big our position can be in any given stock, how effective our positioning can be will be governed by liquidity. That's not an issue that big cap managers really have to trouble themselves with. We need to be on top of our management. We need to know our management reasonably intimately. And in the small cap part of the market, there is a kaleidoscope of colour when it comes to describing management teams, from astute, seasoned, very experienced, right the way through to highwaymen and hucksters who are purely opportunistic and not really committed or investment grade. So management we need to vet, whereas at the big cap of the end of the market, you have somewhat of a luxury that most of the management teams are better than average, I guess you might say. The other important thing is so many of the companies that we invest in are early stage. We need to form opinions on business models, and we need to know whether we believe that these business models are going to work. Some are unproven, so we need to have an element of a risk appetite around a company's relative youth or its early stage that you don't have when you're a big cap manager. And finally, hey, listen, it's no getting away from it. Small cap managers and small cap analysts need to be streetwise. You need to be able to hold your own in the blue. And that's what small cap managers do. And my opinion, with all respect to those large cap managers who are tuning in, you guys kind of aren't in the race when it comes to this stuff.
You mentioned management there. It's always a kind of a tough subject to get your head around. I'm curious, what's your approach to assessing management? What epitomizes a great management team to you? What are some of the things you're looking for when you're going in to meet management for the first time?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's results speak volumes, and clearly track record of a given management or management team are a big driver of how we would at first pass assess management. So results, track record, and experience are certainly high on the list of filters that we apply to any management team we meet for the first time. Management teams aren't always forthcoming with their background, so that'll often prompt some back testing on exactly who these individuals are and do they come with big reputations that are going to work. We've never backed an incompetent manager, no matter how strong or compelling the business underlying the manager is. That's a bit of a maxim that I've always run with. A poor manager will kill a good business. So we're very, very concerned and across management caliber. So experience, track record, we like vision. We like a company that understands, or a management team that understands where the business needs to be and where it needs to go. We like them to understand the workings of capital and capital management. Do they understand the concept of return on equity and weighted average cost of capital? So many companies don't understand that. We need company management teams that have a good grasp of how capital is managed through the business. And the final thing, which is fairly obvious that we would seek out in any management team we back, is we want to see alignment, also known as skin in the game. We need to know that they also have got some personal wealth on the line, and that they are exposed to successful outcomes as much as we are. And equally, they'll feel the pain when things don't go so well. So there's a big answer to a valuable question, but it's part of the black art of managing small cap money is the correct read on a management team.
Yeah, it's certainly a tough one. I'm just going to press you for a little bit more detail. I had one further question on that. How do you approach it with a situation? I'll use a current relevant example, like Afterpay. Now, Nick Molnar, obviously a very skilled CEO, but when that company was fairly new, which I imagine you guys would have been looking at it probably not too long after it listed, he didn't have a massive amount of experience at that point. When you find a situation like that, are you looking at the rest of the team to make sure they've got the backup they need, or is there something else that you're looking for in those situations?
Yeah, that's a great example. And it's an example that's close to Ely Griffiths Group, because we were a very early believer in Nick Molnar. And that came from, to your point, there wasn't a lot of early familiarity with Nick, reputation strong, not a lot of early familiarity with Nick. But there was, however, a great deal of comfort existing between Ely Griffiths Group and the chairman, Anthony Eisen, who we'd had previous dealings with and some experience with in previous corporate transactions. So we knew that Anthony Eisen was a high achieving guy of strong repute, whose expertise in business, whose principles were pretty well unparalleled. On the eve of us sizing up Afterpay as an investment candidate, we had detailed chats with Anthony Eisen, and not only satisfied ourselves that Anthony Eisen hadn't changed much in the intervening years since we last had seen him, but most importantly that he could give us a proper fix and proper colour on Nick Molnar, which involved basically spending one or two or even three sort of periods of catch-up and sitting down with Nick and asking him his vision and why where he thinks he might be wrong with his Afterpay model. So it was really comfort from the chairman, Anthony Eisen, and it was getting to know Nick. It was asking the question. It was speaking to retailers, early adopting retailers of the Afterpay product, and asking them why they were putting so much confidence in Nick Molnar and Anthony for that matter. And again, the feedback came back that their inquiries in the main had also been fruitful and positive. So it's all about triangulating, I guess, viewpoints. It's all about leveraging that experience I talked about, 80 years financial markets experience at Ely Griffiths Group. You know, a good part of that is all about knowing how to trawl a landscape and having trawled a landscape for a number of years. So that's where Eisen comes out. That's where we can get a fix on Nick Molnar. By way of example, it's a good example because it required to the investors at large in the marketplace for one of the market's best performing stocks in the last 2 years, it required somewhat of a leap of faith on who is Molnar and who is Anthony Eisen in some cases.
Well, with all that experience, you've no doubt faced a few challenges in your time running Ely Griffiths Group. Why don't you tell us about one of the really tough ones that you've faced, and, you know, what was it and what did you learn and how did it change you?
Well, Pat, what I'll say to you is operating a boutique, founding a boutique in 2003, I look at the journey that we've been on and I can confirm with you as we speak today that the challenges of running a boutique are manifold. In the early days, it was tackling the institutions who were the traditional managers of money on their own turf, defending our right to exist and validating our case to be able to run a boutique, and we believe run it in a superior way to the institutions at large. That was a battle, and trying to get airtime and try to be heard and try to be taken seriously, that was a battle in the early days. But we grappled with that, and of course the space has been heavily legitimised now with a number of boutiques around. There weren't so many back in 2003, let me tell you. But to answer your question directly, without a doubt, the most challenging set of circumstances that I've had to grapple with, and it would be a career-wide challenge. I'd nominate this as the greatest challenge I had to get my mind around, was how to look after a portfolio of $900 million through the GFC, the global financial crisis, when the market went into a blow-off in late 2007, then spent 2008 into early 2009 in a most horrific give-up. Now, during that time, our portfolios, as I said, we went into that market top with about $900 million of funds under management. And by the time we were dragging our knuckles along the bottom in March quarter 2008, our funds under management were around $380 million. That's some value hit. Now, you've got to live that and breathe that every day. You've got to get through it. I've brought a couple of props along to the podcast today, Pat. I guess it's a bit funny doing a podcast, bringing tangible props to a podcast is a bit like bringing a knife to a gunfight. But what I'm going to do is read out some headlines for the listeners to reminisce on how horrendous those weeks and months were back there in the GFC. September 16, 2008, front page of the Australian Financial Review. Bloodbath for Wall Street banks. Lehman in record bankruptcy. Merrill Lynch sold for $61 billion. Fed's emergency funding. How about this? The hope now is that the downfall of Lehman will usher in a spate of confessions and consolidations in the sector. Then other bylines. Collapse hits councils. Emergency borrowing plans, etc. In October, the Sydney Morning Herald ran a Fortress Australia headline. Nation on an economic war footing. Plan to beat global meltdown. Those headlines were hard to read. They were hard to live with. It made the market a very tough place to navigate. And what we did at Eley Griffiths Group, what we did was prep up a checklist, a bucket list of the features that we wanted to see in that market, because every client was asking us, but when will you know that the market's bottomed? When will you be prepared to recommit your $380 million in round numbers back to the market? And when will this market turn? And that question was asked of us almost weekly. We held a large amount of cash and we had an 8-point checklist. And when about 6 to 7 of those 8 points were triggered, we got to work investing. And that was tough. That was risky because not a person that I could come across thought for a second that the market was bottoming or had bottomed. It was all going low up, so we committed. So I've got to say, managing a bit of money when your name's on the door and you're an investor in the fund and you've got unit holders' interest at stake, to then wade back into the market when everybody's telling you it's the wrong thing to do, especially those headlines of the newspaper I just read out, that took real nerve. And that was a team effort. That was an extraordinary display from our team.
Yeah, it was a crazy time. I'd only just gotten into the industry myself at the time, so it all still feels a bit kind of surreal in hindsight to me. I don't think I really had an appreciation of just how world-changing the events that were going on then were. But it's interesting you mentioned earlier, and something I hadn't really thought about much, but a lot of the investors that are active now wouldn't have even experienced that time period. A lot of people who are investing today would have started after 2009 and not really seen what a true bear market can look like.
Yeah, well, I've seen a couple in my life. When I first started in the industry myself, Pat, since you mentioned that you weren't long into the industry, I started in the mid-80s and I saw the October 87 crash, and I figured I could pretty well tick that off saying, right, I've had that financial calamity in my life. I can now get on with it and build a career. Unbeknownst that, of course, there was another one in the works and a bigger one, but it would take a couple of decades before it was to manifest itself.
And we'd have a tech bubble in the meantime, of course.
Of course, correct, which may or may not be unfolding as we speak. So let's just see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, definitely be interested to discuss that. But let's talk a little bit about your process first. I know you guys use some technical analysis over there at Ellie Griffiths Group, which a lot of fund managers don't admit to using. I've always had a bit of a suspicion that more of them use it than actually admit to using it. But I'd be curious, how do you integrate that technical analysis into your process? Like, what role does it play?
Look, it's a very reasonable question. Look, technical analysis has traditionally received a bit of a bad rap. It's witchcraft, it's sorcery, it's shamanism, it's the Dead Sea Scrolls. It hasn't had a great rap, and yet it's one of the most valuable tools that an investor can use in conjunction with his or her financial or fundamental analysis. At no point would I ever advocate just running a portfolio on technical analysis. But one thing's for sure, as you do your work on a business or a company and you work out, you've assessed the valuation, you do need to be able to fine-tune your entry. You need to know where certain levels of resistance, whether it's price resistance or whether it's natural resistance in the market, you need to know where resistance or support is. You need to adhere to momentum indicators, and we calculate several of those and follow those each day. It's a very, very logical adjunct to your financial disciplines, and it assists greatly with timing, both buying and selling. It basically means that you are unlikely to walk into a situation where you've just bought a failed high. A failed high is something that you need to stand back from. And by the way, we're seeing one right now on Wall Street, a failed high. You need to stand back from a failed high, and equally you need to be very careful when you're selling a failed low. So at the end of the day, I've always regarded technical analysis as somewhat of a roadmap in a foreign city. When you approach a market or a stock, perhaps a stock you haven't bought before, you don't actually know its behavior and how it's going to fluctuate in the market. A good chart, a detailed chart, high-low close chart with several momentum indicators will all of a sudden give you some sort of path as to when you should be buying the stock, how aggressive you should be buying it, where volume occurs at what particular levels. It's a great fail-safe, I think, for any fundamental investor. And I stress again, Pat, I don't urge anyone to use technical analysis on its own. You need to do the fundamental work behind your investments before you step into the market.
I'm curious, have you ever made any attempts to quantify the alpha that technical analysis brings into your process?
Look, I haven't. We haven't done the exercise. I guess it's all about the first issue is attributing, am I buying it because the PE is cheap for the level of earnings per share growth, or am I buying the stock because it's sitting on a 15-year low that's been tested six times and has supported and has held support every time. Why am I buying it? It's a little hard to attribute, I think, why you're doing things. I guess technical analysis has been very useful in deciding when we should actually start taking profits. Certain index levels, you know that a market's going to struggle at. So to answer your question, no, we haven't tried to attribute it. I know it's useful. I know the whole team find it useful, and we're going to keep using it, but I can't actually assign a number or a percentage of how much of our value add comes from it. But it's a good question, though.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit about the current situation? I know you mentioned at the start of this quarter you mentioned in your quarterly report from Q1 that Q2 should tell us whether the current rally is a bear trap or a buying opportunity. Now, today is looking pretty interesting, to be honest. It's probably a bit of a tough day to put you on the spot about this, having, it looks like we're down about 1.5% nearly today off the back of Trump's comments recently. So do you think the current rally that we're seeing, do you see it as a bear trap, or is it a buying opportunity?
Well, what I will say, Pat, it's never a good day to be put on the spot when asked about index levels and where things are going. But I think what you need to consider and what the listeners need to consider is that the period of 2018 was a fascinating time in markets. It was extraordinary. And the market hit a high in January of 2018. It felt like markets globally were going to the moon. And of course, as quickly as a new high was struck, the market stalled. It then spent all of 2018, and our call was approach the market with trepidation, stay on the long side, but understand that the market's going to do one thing this year in 2018, and that's return to the old high. It won't get there quickly. It'll take its good time. It'll probably get there around September-ish. And then we need that will then reset whether have we got a topping pattern in the market, or are we recharging for the next leg up? Well, of course, as everyone remember, the market went to a new high in September briefly, and any technical analyst will have his hat on right now saying, but how did it go? Was the new high validated? And it wasn't. So the market dumped aggressively from late September, and of course, in somewhat of a cataclysm, went into a big low around Christmas Eve. Boxing Day, the stock market rallied hard, like seriously hard. Now these are, as a professional money manager, you've got to try and navigate these big movements. And the low that occurred on Boxing Day, our time, was quite extraordinary. And in the US, it was one of those days they call a 10-to-1 up day. And a 10-to-1 up day is a day when your up stocks volume is 10 times the size of your down stocks volume. You hardly ever see those days. In fact, the last day we saw one of those was, wouldn't you know it, back in the GFC. So navigating
wasn't
that,
March 9, 2009 by any chance, was it?
It was around that time, correct. That's the last time we saw it. So the market has been on a tear from Boxing Day last year through to about 2 weeks ago when the market started to stall again. And wouldn't you want to know it, it stalled around the September high. So to answer your question, have we seen a bear trap? It's very hard to say. The bigger question is, are we in the process of configuring a very large, broader top in equity markets? Now, that rally that we saw out of Boxing Day was too powerful to just be short covering. Short covering rally can happen, it can be powerful, but it tends to peter out over sort of 10 trading days, maybe 20 trading days. This has been quite a long rally from Boxing Day to April. So you see that sort of rally, that is new money going in, that's new longs being put in place on the market. What is interesting though is we've had 100% retracement of that sell-off from September down to Christmas Eve. That retracement has been retraced 100%, and the rally back out from that low in December took place in pretty well the same number of days as it corrected. So the correction down took X number of days. It was about the same number of days on the way out. So that's a unique technical setting called a squaring of price and time. And that's what we saw early April. So that is somewhat troubling. It needs to be monitored. So there's a lot there in that.
So that squaring that you're talking about there, so yeah. You would see that as being a like a bearish pattern?
That's not a great sign, and it's a sign that a retracement or a correction of sorts was in the offing. Of course, that's what we're now seeing, is a retracement from that price and time squaring. So I guess the real question for investors is, we've had a very long, strong, secular bull market from 2009, all the way through to late 2018. In fact, we'll call it to February 19, March 19. That's a very, very long bull market advance. Is the market exhausting itself? Is it forming a top? And it's a fair question. And tops take some period of time to work out. They take, the bigger the move into a top, the more complex the top needs to be. So let's just see what happens with this market. Overbought certainly from its December 18 rally. It needed to cleanse and retrace. Let's see what happens, but it is classic exhaustion price action where bulls aren't sure whether they're convinced anymore, and bears were in the process of giving up after that very strong run-up from December. It's what markets do best at turning points. They confound the bulls, they trip up the bears, and they generally exhaust investors, and people go back to cash. They don't know what to do. And we're seeing the beginnings of that right now, I think.
So it seems that we're at a pretty important inflection point at the moment then.
I think so. Mm. We're watching with great attention as to how deep this retracement ends up being.
I find it interesting how maybe there's a bit of confirmation bias going on here, but it seems that quite often the real world events in politics and markets seem to line up with these technical turning points. And I think it's quite fascinating that the comments from Trump about further tariffs and the retaliation from China have happened right as we've reached this inflection point on the charts.
Well, we sat back the other night after market had closed and looked at you could see the high from September, and the market was, it was still had a way to go. And we said, okay, so what's going to stall this market? And we all just sat there saying, well, nobody's thinking really that the trade deal is going to stall. Nobody's thinking for a second that the Chinese are going to be forced to eat bitterness and we're a bad deal. No one's thinking that. No one's talking it. And that's what's going to probably check this market advance. So I'm not saying that we've got that Eley Griffiths Group have the powers of a soothsayer. But what I am saying is you can have some fun trying to identify actual events, fundamental events that might occur to trigger a resistance level or support level. And in this case, it was clearly a poor outcome for the trade talks, meaning that the old high was rendered valid.
Well, talking about fundamentals, one of the big important fundamentals that is likely to drive the markets in coming weeks, months, years would be the US Federal Reserve. You said at an IRIS event last year that you expected the Fed to pause. You'd just come back from a research trip to the US. That's, of course, what happened. But the US economic data at this stage, I'd say, is still looking pretty strong. There's a few weak points, but I don't think it's particularly controversial to say that the data is still looking pretty solid. So do you think the Fed pause will result in them starting to raise rates again, down the track a little bit? Or have we seen the end of that rate hiking cycle and the next move's going to be down?
Yeah, well, that's the question on everyone's lips. What actually is going on? The Fed has been kind of hard to read. Certainly coming into the end of calendar 18, there was some whipsawing, or I think described as the Fed pivot. So the Fed themselves have been kind of reactionary to things. But look, I think you're right. Our team spent a couple of weeks on the ground in the US in Q4 last year and came back very clearly of the impression that the US economic boom that they've been having was just starting to cool. You're right, there's plenty of stats to suggest some of the mainstays of the US economy remain strong, and the housing market continues, I notice, to be quite strong, and housing stocks and home builders and the like are all strong. The labour market is as tight as you could probably get it. The labour market gets a lot of attention. It should be remembered that the labour market is a lagging indicator. It tells you what's been happening some months ago in terms of employment activity and hiring. I like to look forward and try and see what sort of leading indicators are telling us. And a couple of somewhat worrying developments have occurred on the economic statistic front. I'm anxious that consumer credit expansion has started to moderate in the United States. Consumer credit is like the lead indicator on consumer spending and activity, and that's started to moderate in recent months. That's not great. That'll be fueled by probably slower tax refunds being sent out, and that'll have a knock-on effect immediately on retail trading activity. So consumer credit has slowed its expansion. We've all become very, very close analysts of the Institute of Supply Management, the ISM, And the ISM is a expansion contraction index that measures both services contribution to the US economy and non-services or industrial contribution. The recent ISM has shown that its rate of expansion has been starting to wind back in. So the rate of expansion is now starting to slow. It's back towards 50. And of course, once you cross 50, you go into a contractionary setting. So that started to contract. I didn't like reading the other night that small and mid-sized firms' capital expenditure intentions are being watered down and reduced. So you're getting less of a capital expenditure impulse coming through from middle America. And the final thing I didn't like the look of was the fact that US output growth, industrial output growth, is now slowing, not growing at anywhere near the clip that it was growing at just recently. So a couple of stats there that made me unsettled. Look, I watch I consume as much information about what's going on in the US economy as I can. Our whole team consume what they can. And it was interesting to note that the federal funds futures curve just the other night is now pointing to lower interest rates in the US. So that curve has changed from quite a bullish setting in terms of rates moving upwards to now kind of a bearish setting. So that curve is now suggesting lower rates going forward. That's the first time that curve has indicated lower rates in over 10 years. And I saw a backup survey that said that both economists and investors are also as closely aligned on their thinking on this subject as they've ever been, suggesting that both parties are now starting to think that, yes, the Fed's deferred any hikes this year, that actually a slowdown, a full-blown slowdown is likely to be on the cards. And I haven't even started talking about what the yield curve's been doing. And the yield curve has, as many listeners will have observed, the US yield curve has been talked to death. we've had it in our toolbox for years. It is a valuable indicator. It does tell you that when it inverts, that there's a high probability of a recession, or certainly a growth slowdown or a growth pause. The 90-day into 10-year part of the curve is inverted again last night. That's the second time in about 5 weeks. That's not a great sign. So the yield curve is also giving investors angst. A number of economic stats are giving us angst. All good things must come to an end, of course. The secular uptrend that has been that US economy is in the process of slowing and probably slowing a little faster than mainstream media might have you believe.
That's a scary thought. It's interesting to see there's quite a different story being told in the media. Certainly, you know, as I said before, the perception is that the data is still pretty strong, but there's definitely a lot of food for thought there and some important things for investors to consider.
Well, Pat, I haven't even touched on the trade war and the ramifications of the trade war on the US economy and for what it might do possibly to inflationary outcomes. Inflation has been benign globally. It's been especially benign in the United States. I guess the level of angst will naturally be dialed up when we see the full weight of the tariff imposition felt by producer prices and ultimately consumer prices. So there's also the ogre of inflation potentially in the background. And I don't want to mention it, but I just am going to mention it. And that's the idea of stagflation, where we start to see an economic slowdown and we start seeing the emergence of inflation. And we haven't had that for a while. I'm not putting it out there. I'm just mentioning it briefly, and that's something we need to also be on the lookout for. So there's a few things to curb one's excitement about where that US economy has gotten to and where it's probably going. We need to be somewhat circumspect about now.
Yeah, well, with all that going on, it must be, I imagine, throwing up a few interesting investment opportunities that probably don't look entirely standard. So given this kind of unusual market situation that we're in at the moment, are there any particular sectors or thematics that are looking attractive given this backdrop?
Yeah, well, that's, I guess it's our job as as portfolio managers to rotate our funds under management into places that are safe, or that we detect or have reason to believe are going to be growth areas, or areas that are going to be resilient and will outperform in a relative sense. I think I'll answer it this way. There's one thematic that no one's even talking about, no one's preparing for, no one deep down believes, and that is the thematic of the Australian recovery story. The fact that we've had a housing market that's been hard down since...
I wish the readers could see how surprised I was to hear you say that.
Well, there's a lot going on in terms of sort of stimulus that that we just need to take stock of. And the first thing I talk to is the housing market, which has been going down hard, especially in Sydney and Melbourne, going down hard since the middle of 2017. We're a long way through that retreat in housing prices. And obviously, construction activity has also paid a price on that retreat. That feels like it's probably it's at the later stages of how far that retreat in housing prices goes. We've got a currency that's under all sorts of pressure at the moment, and a cheap currency's good for business. A cheap currency's good for exports, and a cheap currency's great for tourism. It's a great incentive for offshore tourists to visit Australia. We've got a new government, or more than likely, by the time we air this interview, we'll have a new government in Canberra. And like every government, there comes a fiscal pulse, an impulse. So you will see stimulus of some description from the new incoming government in Canberra. So there'll be some fiscal stimulus around the edges, and it might be first home buyers. It's certainly childcare, as we're hearing the battle to win over working mums. So it's childcare, it's housing, it's logical areas that are all productivity related. We're seeing stimulus from government already, and that's before we hear what the Shorten government might have planned, assuming the Shorten government gets in, of course. And of course, going across to monetary policy, we've had the RBA, which was fairly resolute in its decision last year that there was no case for easing rates. If anything, we're probably going to increase rates through the course of 18. Earlier this year, we had the RBA come out and say that the case for rates up or down is evenly pitched. I'd put it to you that the case for rates moving down is now a far more convincing proposition. So let's have a look at it. We've got a possible monetary policy stimulus. We've got fiscal stimulus in the works. We've got the currency cheap. We've got a housing sector that's very, very important, certainly to East Coast activity. We think in the very late throes of its correction. And we've got infrastructure work that's extensive and continues, and if anything's been pushed out, given the scope of trying to achieve all of that work. So there are some quite bullish drivers there that have knock-on effects for the consumer for some period. Building material and construction material companies, service companies involved in infrastructure spend, companies that service our tourism. There are a whole suite of companies there whose share prices have been shunned. We haven't, to any great extent, acted on this theme, but I think it's a theme that people have all but given up on, and I think it's a theme that we need to keep an eye on. It's the re-emergence of the Australian economy, and I think people have just stopped thinking this way. They've become far too bearish.
Yeah, there's certainly no shortage of bearishness around. I know, certainly in all the discussions I've had with almost everyone everywhere over the past probably 12 months, there's just been an incredible amount of negativity about the Australian economy. Whether you're talking about, you know, mums and dads with zero knowledge of the economy, or whether you're talking about professional fund managers or economists, it seems that it could possibly be the most crowded trade in the country right now.
Sure. I think you're right.
Why don't we take a bit of a change of tack? I wanted to get a few tips and tricks from you, actually. We call this podcast The Rules of Investing, but so far it's mainly just been a name. So I want to hear a little bit about what your rules of investing are. What are the tips or tricks or rules of thumb that you picked picked up along the way over your career that have served you well?
Well, Pat, we haven't got a lot of time on this podcast. I could dedicate a whole session with you and I to that very subject. There are any number.
We might have to do that at some point down the track.
Sure, absolutely. I'll be delighted to. But look, a couple I'll share with you that are never far away from my thinking is that investors should know that the market nearly always gives you a second chance. You wanted to sell a stock rallied hard, you didn't sell it, it fell away. You should know that nearly always you'll have another chance to sell that stock. It may not be at precisely the same high share price, but it'll be within vicinity. You need to be ready to do it. Likewise, in a buying opportunity, when a stock gets away from you, nearly always the stock will retrace a part of its run, a good part of its run, and that'll be the setup. So don't despair when stocks move away from a plan you had. You will have a second chance, and that rule of thumb, I can't tell you how often it's looked after us. You will get a second chance, and be sensible about how you deploy your capital. The other rule that I love, and you see it normally at the end of when we've had big upgrade or downgrade cycles in the market, depending where the profit cycle is or where a company's profit cycle is, but you should always buy the last downgrade in a stock's earnings, and you should always sell the last upgrade. And I can hear listeners saying, well, how will you know it's the last? How do you know that? And the answer, quite simply, is you'll know it's the last by the way in which the share price reacts to the news, and hopefully you'll see a large volume reaction. Okay, so buying the last downgrade when a company issues terrible news, the stock dumps, but then the stock turns around and finishes up very strongly on big volume, and a whole bunch of buyers come out of the woods to buy the stock, and you sit there saying it makes no sense why that stock, given that terrible news, why is that stock up strongly? And that's simply...
Like BHP when it cut its dividend, maybe?
Absolutely. Like, exactly like that. And that phenomena you see time and time again. And an experienced investor knows that's the market telling you that the bad news can no longer be absorbed. It's fully discounted. The downgrade cycle is finished. And in any event, most stocks have already turned around about two-thirds of the way through their downgrade or upgrade cycle. On a stock that's been a perennial upgrader, it's already turned tail and is starting to trade lower before the last upgrade, and the converse for the downgrade. So I always use that. I always apply that maxim to my to when I'm investing in the market. And the final one is the most important rule of the market, and it gets lost in this market today where everything's about algorithms and quant trading and day trading and hundreds of books written on it, and it's obsessed about in the media, and I hear it across the desk about the short-term nature of markets. Remember, in matters of finance, one must be patient. And it's another way of saying that the big money in investment in stocks is made in the sitting there and being patient. It's not trying to catch a daily move, a sharp spike sell-off or a blow-off rally. It's all about buying good names at a sensible price, putting those stocks away and holding them, and letting the true fundamentals shine and be reflected in stock prices. So you need to be patient, and the successful and sizable, outsized even, returns for investors will be gained by being patient with stocks. So there are a couple for you, just a couple of rules of thumb and that we employ every day we're at work.
Great advice. Do you have time to stick around for an extra few minutes? Because I've got three favourite questions I do like to go over with every guest, but I do realise that we're pretty close to the end of our time here today. Are you in a rush to leave?
No, I'm fine. I've got another 10 minutes or so.
Okay. Excellent. Cool. All right. So, first of all, could you share something with us that you've read recently? It could be a book, an article, a piece of research, anything like that, that really impressed you or blew you away.
Sure. Obviously, I try and devour as much reading material as I can, and I look at, I read a few magazine and journal articles, and I've got a great library of investment books. There's one book that I keep being drawn back to, and I pick it up, and I always derive value from it. And I bought this book many years ago. You can still buy it. It's called Winning on Wall Street by Martin Zweig. Now, Martin Zweig was a highly successful, accomplished investor, financial strategist, portfolio manager, trader for probably at least three decades on Wall Street. His reputation was enormous. He wrote this book back in the mid-80s, first released in 86, and has undergone subsequent releases, the most recent, I think, being in 97. This book is a book for people who want to get their hands dirty in the market, who want to learn the business, they want to learn the tradecraft of investment management and managing money to win. I'll often read two or three chapters, reflect on it, put the book back, and then come back 6 months later and then read another three. I've read the book so many times I can't tell you. It's an extraordinary piece of analysis, and it tells a great story, and it really outlines, it's a bit of a sneak preview, or an inside look, I should say, on how Marty Zweig, when he was in his heyday, how he approached the market and how he approached stock market investing. So that's a book that is available online, and I bought my book a number of years ago now, but I have seen it. It is absolutely available, new or used. So those who want to get their teeth into something truly, truly satisfying and rewarding could do far worse than Winning on Wall Street by Martin Zweig.
I will. I'll be adding that to my own reading list, I think. But additionally, I'll also put a link in the wire to this podcast. So if any of the listeners want to find that one and didn't quite jot that down quickly enough, just go to livewiremarkets.com and look for the wire for this podcast, and you'll see a link in there. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university and give yourself one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Well, the one piece of investing advice I'd pass on is the principle, as I mentioned, I guess before, that in matters of finance, one's got to be patient. Big money returns on stocks just don't happen quickly. You need to sit and be patient and let a good story unfold. And you shouldn't be afraid. As a good story unfolds and your confidence level rises, and so does the stock price, you shouldn't be afraid to add to that investment. As your conviction grows, you should be adding to it. But all the while holding and letting that stock do what it wants to do. Don't go setting target prices. Just sit there with the stock and be patient. And if you're backing the right management team and the right industry, and you're not paying too much for the growth, then your patience will be rewarded. It's hard. The folly of youth, as they say, wants to trade stocks out and move on to the next great idea. The real money is made just sitting patiently on good stories and letting the market take you upwards. I mean, Warren Buffett will make that comment frequently. I've heard him talk about sitting on stocks and holding, and he's made an art form out of buying good quality names and holding them for decades.
Yeah, he always says, my favourite holding period is forever.
He does too, exactly, and he's right.
Well, one last question for you, but before I get into it, I do always like to include a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. We're not actually suggesting that anybody goes out there and takes all of their money and puts it into a single stock and forgets about it for 5 years. This is supposed to be a bit of an exercise in long-term thinking and a bit of fun. So in that spirit, if the market were to close for 5 years starting tomorrow, and you could only own shares in one company, what would it be?
Crikey, that is a tough one. That could be the toughest question I've been thrown at today, Pat. look, off the top of my head, just thinking about that, that's an interesting one. I'd probably nominate a stock that'll surprise listeners. I'd probably look to nominate Auckland International Airport. as a stock that that I'd happy to go hibernating with, and then awake from a deep slumber in 5 years and just see what they've done. I mean, the stock, it's an infrastructure style stock. Clearly, it operates Auckland International Airport, funny enough, and which is New Zealand's premier gateway. It's how the world accesses New Zealand, and the world is accessing New Zealand in greater and greater volumes. Despite some slightly softer than expected traffic numbers the other day, New Zealand is on and will continue to be on as a destination. Auckland has an enormous airport footprint. Not only does it manage a growing amount of aircraft movements, it's expanding its capabilities. It's going to spend something like $4 billion over the next 10 years on expanding its offering. Auckland International Airport is also one of New Zealand's largest property developers, and so around the greater acreage that is Auckland International Airport, there are all sorts of industrial estates being constructed and commercial centres, and so it's becoming its own industrial commercial hub. Logically, not far from Auckland as a city, logically right there where the aircraft movements are. So it's a fantastic property development play in New Zealand. It has a substantial land package. It's a monopoly style operator in a destination whose attraction to the outside world will only continue. It's very well managed, and I know I hear people thinking, well, running an airport can't be that hard to manage, but there are plenty of moving parts, not the least of which is managing and negotiating with regulators who control a lot of their aeronautical charges. So there are quite a few moving parts to Auckland International Airport, but I have this funny feeling that in 5 years' time, the airport will be bigger, it'll be more successful, it'll have a larger property development arm, it will have achieved even more than it's achieved to date. So you asked the question, Pat, I've got to go into hibernation with the stock for 5 years. I'm taking Auckland International Airport into the borough with me.
Well, hopefully that patience will serve you very well.
Fantastic.
Look, Ben, it's been great to chat with you. I've certainly learned a few new things today. So lots for me to think about as well, and hopefully for our audience too. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's been great to be on, Pat. Thanks for having me on, mate. All the best.